Coming to order. And this morning's informational meeting will be on the relationship, between infrastructure and economic development. Our first panel will be Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and I'd like to call Bob Repine and Ann Hannes up, please. Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
My name is Bob Repine. I'm the director of Oregon Economic and Community Development. Apologize to you, I have a cold, so I'll, in case you think I'm getting a deeper voice here. Ann Hannes will make the presentation on behalf of the agency, but I thought I'd share just a couple of comments with you before she proceeds with that. It was probably a month ago or so, and we had an opportunity to sit in front of this committee and talk about a variety of issues on economic development for the state of Oregon. And at the time, I mentioned to the chair, when he actually challenged me before session starting, what did I think some of the bigger primary issues that the state of Oregon will be faced with as it pertains to the future opportunities around economic development. I mentioned two activities. One was workforce activities, and the other was infrastructure. Hopefully for those reasons we're having that meeting today. Many of you are very aware of the issues that we always talk about on the infrastructure of the highway system, and later after our presentation, I know Department of Transportation people will be commenting on theirs. But there is the there is that unnoticed, unrecognized infrastructure piece that so many times is not as evident as the highways we drive on and we see for the need of transportation of goods and services, but it's the infrastructure to expand the in-the-ground systems of infrastructure, that being sewer, water, cable access, and other forms of communication. And that's really the primary piece I think we want to talk to you a little bit about today. Oregon is growing. It's growing probably in ways that many of us 20 years ago would never thought that Oregon was going to grow. And we can always only believe that in the next 20 to 30 years it's going to grow in ways that no other generation thought of. And with that in mind, the infrastructure has to grow with it. The vitality and the opportunities of a strong economy rely on those infrastructure components to be able to move goods and services from point A to point B, to do it in a timely fashion, to be able to have utilities that will accommodate and facilitate the expansion of industrial applications, both for sewer and water applications. And so we are faced with that interesting situation right now where infrastructure demands, in many cases, generally around the state of Oregon, are old. They are they were funded by financial tools that were available many years ago that are not as available today, that being the federal government. Most of the systems that we have in our cities and communities are vintage 50, 60, 70, 80 years old systems. As we try to upgrade the other forms of infrastructure, sometimes we forget about the infrastructure that's in the ground. And as we also anticipate expansion of either developable land in the state of Oregon in the years to come, it only makes sense that we would be looking at to see how do we expand those infrastructure connections, both sewer and water, at the same time. Which leads us to the fact that when you expand new systems, if you're hooking up to a inefficient older system, it in itself creates problems just because of the connection of that. And so we do have some challenges ahead for the state of Oregon. Earlier meeting here, I passed out to each of you a copy of our strategic plan for the agency for the next 2 years. One of the strategic goals was goal three, and it deals with capacity building for our community partners and our community-related areas. That really does talk about the issues of infrastructure. We realize that a community is going to be ready for economic growth opportunities. When presented those opportunities, they need to be both fit with adequate industrial land base and services and utilities to those lands so that those developing entities have the opportunity to do that development in a very timely fashion. We learned today, or we know today, that development companies or businesses who are wanting to either expand in Oregon or come to Oregon want to get business ready or have a shovel-ready piece of property within 90 days. As you all know, we initially started developing our certified site program under the pretense that we would have shovel-ready buildable land within 180 days. And we learned just in this short period of time that 180 days is really too much time. They wanted to be able to turn it in 90 days. So, at the same time, the infrastructure needs to be there. If you're going to start breaking ground for a new building, you've got to have the facilities ready to go up online when it's ready to open the stores. And so the urgency and the necessity of having infrastructure, all forms of infrastructure, ready and available is crucial for that company, because time is money for them, location is money for them, and product deliveries is money for them. And those are the issues that we are faced with on today's economic front, so as we look and recruit for businesses. Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions, I should say, about any of my comments, I'll be happy to entertain them. If not, I'll let Ms. Hannah start into her presentation.
Yes, Representative Dahl.
Yes, Bob. Last session when we heard from your agency, we got a graph with the shovel-ready sites. There were a number of them. Are those filled? Partially filled? What percentage of shovel-ready sites do you have?
Mr. Chairman, a representative, currently have 50 certified sites, and we have activity going on at least 12 to 14 of those today that either are from the point of acquisition and or are projects coming out of the ground. So doing my math as well as I can in this time in the morning, we're probably about, 25% active. And as time goes by, we are finding many more inquiries about those certified sites, shovel-ready sites. So we suspect, not all of them, because some of them, depending on where they are relative to the industry's needs, there will be a high percentage of those pieces of property have been taken off the marketplace. We're out recruiting for new certified sites to replace those. As most of you members realize, when we put the first certified site list together, it probably would be arguably said that those were probably the lowest hanging fruit. The ones who had access to road infrastructure, had already access to sewer and water infrastructure systems, had little cost related to getting them ready for certified site readiness, but were probably more ready to go than some sites that we would currently be recruiting now for certified sites. So what the message is on that regard is that the projects and the development of land that comes online now will have more complexity and more cost because of how far they are ready from being a 90-day ready-to-go ready site.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, you know, in light of some of the things you've talked about here, and I'm really happy to see some of your focus on these infrastructure projects, because for us to have buildable ready sites, we need to invest in our infrastructure, and specifically when we're talking about growth and the ability of our communities to handle sewage and have available water is increasingly a very important issue for many of our communities. And because the federal government seems to be cutting back on those sorts of available funds to our communities, is the state going to put a little more emphasis and maybe increasing the dollars available for those types of funds as opposed to other types of funds in your overall economic development package?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, currently in our package we have a request for $100 million for infrastructure opportunities using bond sales. So and that is an increase from what we have historically done. So, yes, we're ramping up, assuming that there will be much more activity around infrastructure, that being sewer and water expansions. I don't know whether or not we've really taken that long-range look at what are those costs and what will they be 5 to 10 years from now, and I think that's something very worthwhile contemplating. Ours requests come in as communities need that, they need those resources. We're not necessarily looking down the pipeline as to what are those future needs going to be if they happen to come to us to request funds for infrastructure improvements. And so I think a larger, bigger look of what are those infrastructure needs and how are they going to get addressed in the years to come would be extremely important, because it tells the story of what is the future and what are those obligations we need to be ready to look and deal with, as opposed to just working on a one-by-one basis as they come through my door.
Yes,
follow-up. So I guess just that it is the intention of your department to start looking at that 5 to 10 years out, or is there something that the legislature or this committee should be doing to facilitate that forward look?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holley, I think the agency is in a position to look out down the line a little bit. I think, quite frankly, in my own estimation, that a lot of this has much the same discussion that's going on with the Big Look by LCDC. A lot of relationship there. I may have a financial group that's been looking at the ideas of around infrastructure problems. But I think it requires a very comprehensive look. This will not be a financial number that will be low by any stretch of it. This will be a number that will cause most people to rock back in their chairs and go, wow, did I ever think it was going to be that big? Because it's, in many cases, will be much more than just a replacement of existing lines. It'll be the removal of older, undersized lines and paralleling them with larger lines, which will have horrific cost consequences to them. But of necessity, if we're going to change the system designs that service our communities today to meet the growth that probably was never intended by the original designers of those infrastructure systems. And so I'm familiar with the community that I was raised, or that I grew up in down in southern Oregon, where the original plan for the urban growth boundary area was suggest that certain development was going to take place in certain areas. They put the sewer system in to accommodate that, and then through no changes that were assumed, but the different assumptions than what the planners thought about when they laid out the water system and the sewer system, the line systems had to be all relaid again, paralleling it, because they didn't have enough capacity going in the right areas where they assumed the larger development would have taken place. So I think it's a very comprehensive, detailed look that would have to be taking place with all of our community partners and all the cities that we have out there, really to get a good snapshot of what those needs will be for the state of Oregon. So I think we can do it and go a little bit further out than we currently look. But I think, quite frankly, there's a bigger opportunity for a much broader look involving more people to have this discussion, because I think it's something that's worth both having spending the time on for the sake of Oregon.
Representative Bellum?
Yeah, well, you talked about the number of sites, and 25% of them are active. How many sites do we have on the eastern side of the mountains that are ready to go, shovel ready?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have, I'm trying to picture the map in my head.
I think 5 to 10 sites.
I'd say probably 20% thereabouts, 15 to 20% of the sites are on the east side of the Cascades.
Could we see a copy of that?
Sure.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Good luck to you.
And Ann, before you start, I'm just going to ask the audience, we're getting a little feedback through our audio system, which probably means that someone's cell phone or BlackBerry is on. So if everyone would please check those items and make sure they're turned off, we'd appreciate that. Thanks very much. Ann.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Infrastructure is the economic building block for our economy. We have the future prosperity of our economy is directly.
Excuse me, Ann. Would you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Ann Hannes, Acting Community Development Division Manager for Oregon Economic and Community Development Department.
Thank you.
The future prosperity of our economy is directly tied to our ability to adequately fund infrastructure, be it in the form of sewers, water mains, roads, energy and communication utilities, piers and ports, jetties, public buildings, and appropriately developed lands. I think you've heard an awful lot about the global economy, but things are changing tremendously. In fact, we're going to be looking at freight increases of over 60% over the next 10 to 15 years, and that has immense implications for Oregon, not to mention our geographic position here. We have the opportunity to be able to tap into that growth tremendously. Let me give you an example. If you look at what's going on in California in terms of the freight coming in through their ports, they're becoming clogged and congested. If we had the opportunity to tap even a small percentage of that, it could be immense in terms of our economy for this state. Let me talk a little bit about what's going on with businesses today. They are often at a point where they need to be able to react quickly. They need to be able to build within 90 to 180 days, as Bob had mentioned. They also have what are called just-in-time inventories right now, where the inventory isn't in their companies. It's in the rolling stock on the highways. It's in the ships. It's in our airports. And unless we provide the infrastructure necessary to transport that and get that to the sites, it will directly affect our competitiveness. We give the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department provides loans and grants to eligible public entities. We have about 9 funds for the purpose of studying, designing, and building public infrastructure that leads to job creation and retention. The largest fund that we manage is the Special Public Works Fund. This gives out about $60 to $80 million a year in loans and grants, primarily loans, though, but we do have some grants, and that's given out for water systems, wastewater systems, transportation systems, building and associated infrastructure to support industrial manufacturing and different types of commercial development, too. These dollars leverage private and public sector investment and also add to our tax base. As an example, we invested about $4.4 million in various road and public infrastructure projects at the Canby Pioneer Industrial Park. The assessed value of the certified industrial site grew from $1.8 million before the investment was made to over $37 million. The increase in property taxes alone was $500,000, and in the past 2 years, the 45 acres of that site have sold for over $6 million, and 150 jobs have been created. At full build-out, that's going to mean 700 jobs for the state. Another example is Genentech. The governor recently announced this in the last year. It's a major biotech company coming to Hillsboro, and it'll bring 250 jobs in the biosciences business cluster. A key factor in Genentech's decision to move here was our ability to quickly make water system and transportation improvements. For example, the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Transportation Commission has a very flexible and very rapid tool that it can use in the form of the Immediate Opportunity Fund. And that was critical for the decision of Genentech to locate here. We've also found that to be true with other projects in Molalla, Albany, Lebanon, and elsewhere around the state. We have seen over the years that have made significant progress with about $153 million in infrastructures projects that have been funded by lottery bond proceeds that have been managed by Oregon Economic and Community Development, as well as the first round of Connect Oregon and improvements to our highway system. However, much more remains to be done to ensure that Oregon remains competitive. But I think it's important to recognize that other states and even other countries are not standing still. They are making significant investments in their infrastructure as well because they recognize its importance. So underscoring that importance for infrastructure to our economic goals, the governor strongly supports another round of Connect Oregon, as well as $100 million capital infusion from lottery bonds into the infrastructure funds managed by Oregon Economic and Community Development. There was a study that was recently commissioned by Oregon Economic Community Development to look at the impact of infrastructure projects. And let me just share a couple of the results of that. They looked at 56 projects that occurred in 1999 and 2000. They found that there was less than a 6-year payback in terms of increased income tax revenue to the state for the amount that was invested. Oregon Economic and Community Development Department invested about $36 million, and that leveraged over double that amount in total funding for all the projects of infrastructure. It also resulted in total direct and indirect jobs of 11,000 jobs. That's huge for Oregon's economy. But let me also mention that there are other economic benefits that go along with infrastructure improvements, including a more diversified economy, increased residential growth, better water quality, fire protection, a sense of community, and improved access. So in summary, without having this infrastructure in place, it will be very difficult to remain competitive, and it will be very difficult to continue to have developable land available for industry to either stay here or to locate here. You'll also be hearing today from Chris Cameron, who is our technology specialist, and he will be talking about the importance of infrastructure from a technology standpoint. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ian? Representative Colby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed, you know, you're talking a lot about infrastructure, and I couldn't agree with the department more about the importance of that. And of course, you know, having that shovel-ready property to attract industry to locate here provides us future jobs. But oftentimes I wonder whether we're leaving out the importance of the construction jobs that are needed to build those projects. And specifically, in your written testimony, you mentioned the Lowe's distribution facility. So I'm somewhat curious about our policies around that as a state, noticing that, you know, economic development and the business council have all recognized the importance of making sure we're producing higher wage jobs with our investments. And I don't know specifically, but I think the Lowe's Corporation got about $12 to $13 million in state funds to facilitate them moving there, which is all good because they're producing good jobs. But on the construction side of that, it sort of bothers me that that particular project hired a contractor from Kentucky who hired a subcontractor from Southern California, Bakersfield, I believe, Baymar, I believe, construction, and they brought up their labor force mostly from south of the border and paid them $10 to $12 an hour when the rates are for I think it was over 30,000 hours of carpenter hours at $10 to $12 an hour when our wage here, not even below our, not even speaking of our prevailing wage, but ought to be commanding $20 plus an hour for those sorts of jobs. And that seems to be contrary to making an investment in good Oregon jobs and watching those jobs be performed by people from out of state who, after the project is over, sometimes will move back to where they came from, but sometimes they do not, which puts another burden on our revenue system in many, many instances. And so I'm curious about our policy of not protecting those construction jobs to the standards that are in Oregon and allowing our investments from the public go to with no strings attached to how they get the project done and watching those public dollars go out of state at reduced rates. It really bothers me, I guess, policy-wise, that we do that with economic development dollars. I'd like you to comment on the wisdom of that kind of policy of not really having any kind of standards or criteria set for the actual construction of these projects.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the wisdom in that. The agency has obviously been charged with, I mean, our mission, as the statutes would suggest, is to create jobs. And that's why you always hear us talking about the new jobs that will either come about because of the either expansion or the retention and or a new company that might come to Oregon. So we will always talk about the new jobs that added to the existing base of jobs in Oregon. I think your point is a valid point. I would tell you, suggest to you also, as you brought up the Lowe's facilities, if in fact that's the way the contracting was done for the development, which I have no doubt that it was. We know of other companies that come here and don't do that, but are very conscientious about trying to hire Oregon employees and Oregon workers to accomplish the work at hand. Again, I can't speak to either defend or deny what Lowe's has or has not done. And as those jobs are being paid to a company that's out of state, and the payroll gets eventually into the hands of the people who are in residence here for at least the construction period, there are some advantages, some turning of dollars that advantages Oregon's economy. So there is some aspect that we do gain something from it. Do we gain as much as if they were state-based, people who work in the state of Oregon today and in the future? Probably not. And so I think that's a discussion is a good discussion to have. How much limitation or criteria do you want to put around the resources the state of Oregon makes? Now, having said that, what we have to do, I think, is also very important for anybody who thinks about that discussion, is to look outside of the state of Oregon and find out what other competing states are doing relative to their funds. I would suggest to you or tell you that competition for placement of companies is very, very cutthroat. There are states, and if you were to rank Oregon, what we have to put on the table relative to either recruiting a business or maybe retaining a business that's here in Oregon today who might be thinking about going somewhere else based on the offers that they could be considering by those other states is a significant difference. I know of one where an offer was made to a company that was 10 times the amount of money that Oregon finally put into money that we put into the deal. Now, they took our offer because they liked what Oregon had to offer. But if other states are making kind of those financial overtures to companies without any limitations, one has to kind of step back and say, okay, if you were to put some kind of constraints or requirements for employment, whether 100% or 50% or 20%, that it has to be Oregon-based employees that do work on this job. You just want to be mindful of the fact, what are the other competing states going to, how do they compete and stack against you relative to those type of controls or constraints on finances they might be putting in. And that's not to say at the end of the day we'd say, no, in the best interest of Oregon, it still makes sense to take an approach that says, when you make investments in company, there should be some accountability or responsibility that company would invest in Oregon workers. And I think that's a fair discussion to have.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you. You mentioned a little bit about transportation infrastructure. And I just kind of want to follow up on that. I agree wholeheartedly on the water and sewer portion of that. A traffic jam in rural part of my district might be two people at a stop sign together. I mean, we don't have congestion out in certain parts of my district. If you drive up into the Tri-County areas, it's definitely a problem. Is there any way, have we looked at kind of regionalizing funding mechanisms to deal with transportation issues? Now, I know the port was in here, and they were talking about the I-5 corridor being kind of critical for them, and the Department of Transportation is going to follow you, so I'm going to ask them the same question. But specifically, kind of, if the strategy of maybe having a variable gas tax throughout the state would be kind of something that would be suggestive.
Chair Witt, Representative Gerard, I think a real good example to looking at the regional and statewide approach was Connect Oregon. And your district is in the Staten area, correct? Well, one project that was in Connect Oregon that was funded was a rail line that connected a certified site in Staten so that you could be able to ship products up through the Portland area. That's an example of trying to deal with congestion and making the site more in Staten much more marketable to be able to bring jobs to that area. When Connect Oregon the projects were identified and ranked, they were done on a regional basis and also looked at statewide. So even while you may not have somebody in a car or a truck having to wait long in the area, if they can't get their product shipped through Portland or whatever, it's going to make it very difficult for them to make a decision to be able to stay there. So the upgrading of short line rail lines, road infrastructure becomes critically important, and I think that's one of the reasons why there is so much support for another round of Connect Oregon.
Representative Dolan.
Ann, I've been waiting for you for a long time. Connect Oregon 2, communities that are diversified and grow, regionalized funding from my colleague, building infrastructure, alleviating congestion, railroad, river, highway within 2 hours maximum of Portland Airport, all exists in my district. But we can't seem to get the look that way. If you were to come to, and I'll pick a community, the Dalles or Arlington, we offer all of those things. And we believe in our district that someday the growth is going to come up the Columbia River. So maybe when you see the application for Connect Oregon and it says Arlington, you'll look at it with love.
Thank you.
Thank you both very, very much.
There was a question in there, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you know, there were a number of projects, I'm sure with Representative Dolan, that were funded by Connect Oregon up in your area that were important, ones that would improve the ports up the Columbia River, ones that would improve rail with upgrading of I believe a Hinkle Yard in that area. So I believe that the next round will also offer other opportunities for communities that find it difficult to fund the amount that's required, because infrastructure, let's face it, is frightfully expensive and growing more so every year. Construction costs have gone 10 to 20% on an annual basis. So having these kinds of funding available for communities is a major shot in the arm for especially rural communities.
Let me have a follow-up statement. I think that's our problem. We have all of the things that you described, but there's a certain critical mass that a community has to have just to participate in these projects, and that's where we have a tough time,
mm-hmm.
is our tax base, our population. We'd have to borrow one of your cars to have two cars at the stoplight. So there's a critical mass that we have to have, but I do think we have some... we have some things to offer, particularly when I think about Arlington with a port there. But even getting up to the level where we can ask for a match is very difficult.
Chair Witt, Representative Dolan, one of the things that we've tried to do over the years is to be creative in how we package these different projects. A lot of times you can take money that is we get from the federal government, match it with state funds, and be able to then help a community out that would not be able to provide that match, or in some circumstances be able to provide a grant that then allows the leveraging of federal funds or other types of funds that require the match. So we try to be creative that way, but do recognize that it's often very difficult for some communities to be able to put the money forward for that.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back to the shovel-ready site, what exact definition shovel-ready? Is it the land is available, or is the infrastructure is all ready to go? Could you define it and explain it to us? Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, interestingly enough, shovel-ready has a series of different definitions. It's somewhat in the eye of the beholder. I think the way that Oregon has adopted the shovel-ready concept, and I might get people in the back who will disagree, I don't know, but it is my estimation that shovel-ready in Oregon, as we apply it to certified sites, is there, these are sites that have all the have gone through a process of identifying issues that will be germane to the ability to develop that land. So there would then have been a wetlands either a delineation or assessment. There would be a transportation assessment that says relative to a generic type of a company locating there that creates either so many jobs or so many vehicles coming in and out, the system will or will not support that site. So it gives you somebody a baseline of understanding what the likelihood of that property is to be serviced by the systems that are in and around it today. It would do an assessment of what the utility capacities are, that being the power company, whether or not there is, if a company was going to locate there that had a high demand for electricity, that the electrical analysis would be done to either determine whether it would or would not meet an expectation of services needed for that site based on the type of company. And so, in our estimation, shovel-ready means much of the underlying review of either the infrastructure or the uses of the land have already been laid out and delineated so that when a company does come in, because you don't know what the company is and what their needs are yet, you can start drawing those either reports or analysis together relative to what that specific company has in mind for the use of that land. Now, there are some definitions of shovel-ready that are clearly permit in hand, so its systems are there, it's ready to go. So you buy the land and you can put it, literally, as the title would suggest, put a shovel in the ground and start working on it. We are not at that level yet. And so for some reasons it's obvious because you don't know what company is going to come there, so it's very difficult to say, I'm ready for anybody who comes across my threshold or my doorstep. So ours is more of a preparatory look at what are the items around there, what are the things that would keep a company from being developable or a piece of property from being developable, and how do you go ahead and get it teed up in a way that if a company did come, you could move quickly and succinctly through that process in order to get it ready for them.
Please.
There has been a big issue concerning the system development charge. And do the state negotiate with them, or is county or city, they do negotiate separately concerning the system development charge, including some charges for the schools in their areas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, I assume that you might be speaking of enterprise zones where there might be overlays on, well, maybe not, but you might be talking about just system development charges. Generally, system development charges will take on a negotiated aspect with the community. Again, system development charges being more germane to sewer and water, and some system development charges include parks. And so the company will go into a negotiation on what those might be, or at the end of the day might be paying exactly what the system development charges would suggest they should be paying. There has been some discussion of late in the building around enterprise zones where certain tax obligations are deferred or not paid as through a period of time as the development is under an enterprise category. Where at that time, much between the business and the local jurisdictions, those issues are negotiated for them, so funds can be discussed with helping facilitate extra fees to be paid for schools and say, fire districts if needed. So there are some two-way discussions that take place around that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Polby. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps just a statement in, I guess, response to Director Repine's comments about us being able to attract companies by competing with other states and what we're able to offer, and I guess just a statement about the policy concerning wages. On a construction project, I believe that the average percentage of the project is due to wages is about 20%, 20 to 25% of the project. And I guess I think that what we know about economic development and the importance of having good wages and how important that is to our economy, having people being able to buy homes or take care of themselves without having to rely on the state revenue system for many of their needs, I really think that it's bad policy that we would compete with other states by lowering wages and undermining wages in any sector. And I just think that that is a misguided policy of this state to allow us to undermine and lower wages as a means of competing to attract companies. Because we have a lot of other avenues, as you know, to compete by offering the abatements and tax incentives, enterprise zones, and having shovel-ready property by making those kinds of investments rather than saying we're going to lower wages and that's part of our investment. Because I think that's contrary to our goals as a state of raising our annual income for people in Oregon, which is below the national average. And I think it would behoove us to look at policies that don't allow below average wages and to undermine huge segments of our economy in the name of competing with other states. I think that's a race to the bottom and will not benefit our state in the long run. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Representative Holby, again, my statements were not necessary to support the idea that we would be we want to play a cutthroat game with other states. As you used your example relative to the Lowe's facilities, and again, not having a lot of understanding of how they went about recruiting the workers there, but I know that there are examples in the state of Oregon where we have had good Oregon jobs being used, workers from Oregon's workforce being used to help facilitate that construction. Do we have a template or a tool that requires it? No, we don't, and I think that's more important to the issue that you're raising. Should it be something we've discussed? Absolutely. Is it a fair discussion to have? You bet. I think racing to the bottom is a poor economic tool for any state, including Oregon, to want to be the reason why we encourage development. Development should be encouraged with a process in mind that benefits all Oregon all the time. How that is accomplished is a discussion that should be had. But the reality is that we do, the only reason I raise that issue is that there is a huge amount of state competition out there that we compete on a regular basis. One of the discussions that we had with a company who we put about $4.5 million in locating here in Oregon to come to Oregon because the company was seeking to look at other states. We were vying against another state that had $40 million on the table. Our $4.5 million that we gave them was for very specific improvements to Oregon's infrastructure and the workforce in Oregon, very germane to the development in itself. The other state was competing that they were looking at was going to give them $40 million just to write them a check for $40 million with not any requirements whatsoever to use that money for. So for what little money we have, we have a lot of constraints on it. Do we have an overlay constraint on the requirement of these companies using Oregon workforce on an ongoing basis or some percentage basis of all their construction? No, we don't. Is that a discussion that's a fair discussion to have? Yes, it is. But it isn't an intent of this agency or under my leadership that we want to be racing for the bottom, because you're right. Running for the bottom of that kind of race only guarantees you failure.
Can I add to in the state's infrastructure funds that it manages, the Special Public Works Fund, for example, one of the major criteria we look at for jobs that are created over the long term are whether or not they're at or above the state's average wage, and they are also targeted at traded sector or clusters that are part of the state's strategic plan and strategy for economic development, and that has been a way to bring in those type of traded sectors that bring in jobs that are at or above wages. And particularly when you consider that 75% of the funding that goes out, like from the Special Public Works Fund, goes out to rural and distressed areas.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. During that last answer, you mentioned the company where we put in, $4.5 million, and another state offered them $40 million, and they came here. Can you give me some of the reasons that they came here?
And I didn't want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair. I don't want to name the other company because state, because if I told you, you'd just say, well, that's obviously the answer to the question. it's flat, it's warm. How's that?
almost in the middle of nowhere. But the I'm sorry, I lost my thought. I was going to be clever here, and that didn't work.
It's too early in the morning.
Ann, why don't you go and fill in? Your committee chair said, well, I hope you make them laugh today. Clearly, one of the things that did finally convince that company to locate here, and again, this was a company that could have has facilities in other parts of the world and could locate literally anywhere. Okay, so they currently have a West Coast presence, and so they were looking at something that was convenient for them to be able to move from their other West Coast facilities in and around the metropolitan area. So the transportation was an issue that they looked at very strongly, quite frankly, because of the frequency of flights that they can move in and out of. The transportation of product to the ground transportation system, because this will be a facility that requires them to bring in quantities of materials and then to handle those products and then once again ship them back out. So it's an in and out facility somewhat. So that transportation, ground transportation, was key. The technology, the intellect that their company requires them to have, being close to the university system up here, particularly Oregon Health Sciences facility, will be a huge advantage to them. That's another thing they looked at. And then I think the other piece is the quality of life. They're moving from an area from a West Coast state that does not afford them what they believe are the values that they want to raise their families, as opposed to the predecessors of the company who located where they did locate because of the quality of life standards they saw at that time. And so you have a next generation of people saying, the quality of life I want for my family is different, and what I see in the Northwest area, particularly in the Portland area, gives me that quality of life.
Thank you.
Last question for this panel, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I think we've heard it. I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you both very, very much for your excellent testimony. I think you've set the stage very well that our economy moves on our infrastructure. I appreciate you coming here this morning. Next up from the Aviation Board, we have Mike Burrell.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to be here. Again, for the record, my name is Mike Burrell. I chair the Aviation Board for the State of Oregon. We've had some changes in the Department of Aviation in the last 3 days, working days. And with me this morning, I have Dan Clem, who is the new acting director for the Department of Aviation. Our former director resigned on Wednesday of last week. So Dan is trying to get his hands around what aviation is all about as we begin to plan for our future. I have submitted to you a written testimony, but I'm going to not follow that because that's the way I tend to do things, and you can read as well as I can. So instead of doing that, I think what I will do is just start off by telling you a little bit of my background, because as I listen to Bob Repine and Ann talk about economic development, I want you to know that at this point in my life, I'm semi-retired, and my two passions in life are transportation in its many modes and economic development. My business that we still operate, my sons are running, we do commercial, industrial, real estate development and sales. We have a certified site that we are working with, so as we get into questions, if you have questions around that where I can change hats, I'd be happy to try to do that. Economic development in Oregon and transportation, the linkages are not only roads, highways, trucks, seaports, and all of those that you've already heard about, but airplanes and aviation. One of the concerns that I have as we look at the entire state, we have 7 commercial airports. Of those commercial airports, 3 of them are struggling. 1 is really struggling. The airport at Pendleton, because of its location, because of the population, because of the draw that they have and the potential that they have, is one that we worry about. If you you look at the maps over there, you find that going north to Walla Walla, they have about the same type of commercial coverage. If you drive just a few miles further, you can go over to the Tri-Cities where they have very, very good commercial coverage. So it makes it very difficult for Pendleton to be able to grow. Astoria wants to have, and Newport want to have commercial air service. That's another issue that will be back in front of all of us with Connect Oregon 2, I'm sure. North Bend is doing well with the growth that's taking place at Bandon. Klamath Falls is growing. Medford, Eugene, of course, and Redmond are doing quite well. But we have about 98 public use airports in the state of Oregon. Right now, the Department of Aviation is in the final stages of a study that's being done by a company called Mead & Hunt. Part of that study is to develop an aviation system plan for the state of Oregon. And in doing that, what we want to do is to be able to identify those public use airports that are significant to the system in Oregon. Now, if you travel around the state and talk to any community about their airport, everybody wants to have automated weather systems. They all want to have global position approaches. They all want to have runways that are over 3,000 feet long. They all want to have parallel taxiways, lighted runways. Ways, you name it, they all want it. But we can't afford to do that with all of them, nor are all of those airports really capable of supporting that type of activity. I'm sure you have read about the new generation of aircraft, the very light jets that they're talking about, the ability to go places where we don't normally go now. So what we want to do is to make sure that we have a system that we're funding properly, developing properly, that we can, within regions at the very least, be able to support those types of aircraft, those types of growth that are going to take place. If you stop and think about service to the people of Oregon, there are people that will complain to you that they have to drive more than an hour or maybe more than 2 hours to get to a commercial airport. And yet, I think if you were to go to the Los Angeles Basin, you would find people in the Los Angeles Basin that in miles are closer, but in time to get to their airports, they will spend more time traveling than our citizens in Oregon. That doesn't make excuses for not providing service, but we can't have, in a state like ours, have commercial air service to every community, so we have to find how we're going to make it work, and general aviation is one of the ways of making that happen. Part of what we're doing in our study also is an economic impact study, looking at what the airports actually do to the communities. We've done interviews and surveys with businesses, with the governments, and we want to find out really what that airport means to those communities. It's coming along well. We would hope to be able to use that information to guide us when you approve the next round of Connect Oregon. And if we know where those improvement needs are supposed to be and if they're part of the strategic system for Oregon, it's going to be a lot more easy to identify the projects that we need to fund. As I listen to Bob and Ann talk, you think about infrastructure, it's pipelines, it's airports, it's roads. They mentioned the fact that there was a 60% projection for 65% growth in cargo, and if, you know, over the next 10 years, well, the 20-year projection is about double. And the 20-year projection on cargo by air is about that same number. If you look at the airports in Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, you'll find that they are reaching capacity. I saw a report from SeaTac that they published that shows that within the 20-year horizon, their hole that they're in terms of ability to meet the demand that is forecast is so big it would take an airport the size of Portland International to meet that hole. Another thing to keep in mind is that to build a new runway, let's take Portland International as an example, that if you started from zero and decided today and you told them you must build a new runway, it could be 15 years before they could land an airplane on that runway by the time they go through all the studies. So what you're doing here and thinking about the future and projecting out there and beginning to invest in projects looking way out is what we have to do because it doesn't work any other way. what I see with our commercial airports here in Oregon is that we need to be invested. We did that in Eugene with the last round of Connect Oregon. But we invested in a portion of their cargo ramp for bringing aircraft in, the cargo jets like UPS and FedEx would come in with. The original plan that Eugene had was to put a ramp in that would handle the small, what we call box carriers, the small planes, the small FedEx planes that jump around the state. And they were trying to make a system around that. I pushed them to not only do that, but to put in a tarmac big enough to bring in a 757, because there's going to be times that that's going to be what needs to be done. I'm working right now trying to put together a kind of a private meeting with the United Parcel and their executives to talk about, behind closed doors where it isn't a public thing, what it is that they see for the future. Because they're not going to come in front of you. They're not going to come before my board and tell us that, because it's proprietary. But I want to know what their thoughts are and how they see their growth in the West. Because I would like to be able to use that knowledge, or have the department use that knowledge to help, and you to have it some way to guide us in our planning and our investments in the future. I think I will stop and open it to questions.
Thank you very much, Mike. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. You mentioned a number of airports on the coast and in other parts of the state where, based on my very limited knowledge, I suspect that there are significant weather-related problems. I know even at Mail and Suite in Eugene, we have fog problems there. You also mentioned technology as, and the fact that we may not get as much as we want. Are there things that should be done, that can be done, in order to make those regional airports function during times of difficult weather, and thereby improve the reliability of both general aviation and perhaps even scheduled aviation service?
Mr. Chair, yes. As part of my presentation today, I was going to bring some photographs, and I just ran out of time. But if you were to look in the Flying Magazine or Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association magazine and look at some of the ads that are there showing the instrument panels on the modern aircraft that are coming out, and then if you were to find a copy of what those instrument panels looked like even 10 years ago, what you see is so totally different. I want you to picture a panel, and this is one that I've seen recently. It's in a Piper Meridian. This is a single-engine airplane, and Cessna does the same thing in their single-engine, but in front of the pilot, instead of having the round dials that we've had in airplanes for years, there's a computer screen. It's about 14 inches across. In front of the co-pilot side, there's another computer screen, and then there's another big one right in the middle. And I've flown for years. I've got over 4,000 hours of flying everything from antiques to jets. So through the years, you have your what we call Jepson charts, and you open up your book with all these charts, and you thumb through them, and you find frequencies and your approaches and all that stuff. With this new technology, you push a button, and the approach shows up on the screen. It has the ability to download directly into those screens current weather. You're getting it from satellites that comes in there, and you're able to see all of that. A portion that we funded with the first round of Connect Oregon, called ADS-B, was somewhat of a controversy with some people that didn't understand it or didn't like the concept, but it is the cutting-edge technology. In fact, the gentleman with the FAA in Washington, D.C. that I talked to said that it is so cutting-edge, it's just like the Internet in the late 1980s, that it's going to be explosive. So picture with me this same screen in the airplane, and there's a little box that's attached to the system that takes the information from GPS. It says, this is where I am in the sky. It sends it off to a box that's on the ground, and that's what Oregon is paying for, is the box on the ground. The box on the ground then combines what my airplane is sending along with your airplanes that you're in, takes all of that, sends it back up into the air, and now it comes in on the screen in my airplane and in yours, and can show you exactly. I can see where your plane is and what your altitude is different than mine, and I can see what direction you're going. So I've got information that's nearly as good as what the guy with the radar at the control tower has. They also have technology so that if I wanted, by pushing another button, where they have train mapping, that all is part of the satellite system, I can cause it to create what I'm going to call black spots within the picture that you see in the train. And as long as I fly in the black spot, I'm guaranteed of a certain amount of feet of elevation separation from mountains and towers and everything else. So if you were to lose an engine and you're at night or in the clouds, you could go to that and stay in the black, and you're going to get to the lowest point that you can possibly go. Technology is absolutely on the cutting edge, and it's unbelievable. In fact, we may buy an airplane that has a lot of that in. I had stopped flying. I will not try to learn it. I'm too old. I don't want to do that. I have a son that's good at it. Either that or get one of your grandkids, because they can figure it out. I can't. But we're there.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm from Hillsboro, and as you probably know, there's one of the major topics of conversation in Hillsboro is the effect of the Hillsboro Airport on quality of life. And I heard you earlier say that you had discussions with the ports, the airport folks and business folks to determine what to do in the future. But I didn't hear you say anything about talking with the people who live around the airports.
We do that, but not maybe not as well as we should. But I don't want to get into any argumentative. But think of what I think of is thinking of it from the airport side, the aviation side. And so you're thinking of it from the citizen that lives out there, and it's a quality of life issue for those people who have airplanes flying over their head. I would allege that in many, many cases, the airport was there first. And so people buy and build their house off the end of the runway, and then they decide they want to complain about the airport being there. And I don't know the answer to that. I think it comes back to zoning, to restrictions on what can go there, notifications. One of the things that we're talking about in the Aviation Board, the Department of Aviation, is to have disclosure on real estate transactions. And at some point, that's going to come in front of you. And we're hoping to work with the real estate folks to be able to come up and because disclosure is so important, because we don't ever want somebody to move in and then say, but I didn't know. They need to know.
Absolutely. And follow up, if I may. Yeah, and I agree with that. There's quite a bit of that. On the other hand, I'm on the HAIR board, by the way, the Hillsboro Airport Initiative. I forget what HAIR stands for, but it's the citizen board for the Hillsboro Airport. And our biggest problem there is helicopters. They weren't there when most people built their houses. And as you well know, helicopters are probably the most irritating, the noisiest, and they hang around. They don't go away.
That's what they're supposed to do.
We're hoping they don't.
They stay around because we have one of the largest helicopter training schools on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And it's become a real problem. And I'd like for you to think about, and I'm not going to get into it today. It's just tossing it out there. I'd like you to think very seriously in your new job. Okay. About how to mitigate some of that problem, because I guarantee you it's the biggest issue that I hear about of any issues that we have. That's the biggest one I hear about is the helicopters over my house.
Mr. Chair, there is no doubt in my mind that the Port of Portland does extensive outreach to the citizens around the Hillsboro Airport. The state of Oregon owns the airport at Aurora, and we have some of those same types of problems with the development that's off the north end of that airport, because those folks don't like the airplanes coming over. When there's any talk of lengthening the runway, doing something different, they're always there. And we do outreach. We try to include them in all the planning that takes place. By the way, if you didn't know, the Aurora Airport has 47 corporate jets that are based there. Surprising to me, but that's just the latest inventory. aviation is growing, and I don't know how you take care of it. Your concern about us being able to solve the helicopter problem, that airport is an airport for commercial activity. The helicopters are part of that commercial activity, and I totally understand because helicopters can be annoying. They go by my house, too. But I don't
stay over your house.
Pardon?
They don't stay over your house.
Depends on who's flying them.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought of my second question right after I relinquished the floor. And just one comment about this one. Maybe you should move the helicopter training program to Pendleton and install two things at the same time.
Yes, please.
but that wasn't what I wanted to talk about.
Same thing if you went to the Dalles. The Dalles Airport is in Washington, so we'd shove the problem across the river. Then.
Okay. The question I really had to do with general aviation and also with I guess corporate. Maybe they're the same thing. I'm not sure.
It is.
But I'm wondering if this is a multi-part question, and I'm wondering what the trends are in terms of costs for modern airplanes. Is the trend in terms of usability and cost per trip or cost per mile or however you measure these things going up or going down? Is it likely that people are going to increase their use of general aviation to get around and move small merchandise as well as people? And simply a note as I think about it, several years ago when I was looking at a college for one of my kids, we discovered that it would be a lot less expensive and a lot easier in terms of time to rent a plane and a pilot and fly direct rather than buy several tickets on commercial airline and fly to several different airports along the way to get to the place we wanted to go. So I can understand what the draw is for general aviation. And is there more infrastructure needed in that area for people like me who are only going to rent a plane and a pilot occasionally? A multi-part question. Sorry.
Well, let me ramble a little bit then, Mr. Chair. Back in 1979, I bought a Piper Cheyenne at that time that was a twin-engine prop jet, could carry eight people, cruised at about 240 knots, and it cost a little over $700,000 in 1979. We're looking at different airplanes now, and a small piston engine, single engine, with non-pressurized, with modest instrumentation, no de-icing equipment, is going to run you somewhere close to $500,000 for that airplane. To get an airplane comparable to the one I bought in 1979, you're going to be looking at around $3 million for a twin engine. You can get single engine prop jets that now will sell for the two, some up as high as $3 million range. Now, are they cheap to operate? No. They're more efficient than they were in 1979 because the engines are better, the fuel economy is better, but they're not inexpensive. But what makes them work and the demand that we have on the system, if you go back 5 years, at that time we had a lady that was on our aviation board who was a corporate pilot, and she flew and still flies a Citation jet for a company out of Salem here. And she had time at that time to be able to do her job and be on our board. After 9/11, her company said, we will not let our executives fly commercial anymore. So now they all use that airplane. She's gone all the time. So you see that happen. The delays, if you start here in Salem and you drive to Portland and you have to be there 2 hours ahead of time to get your commercial flight to go someplace, and then you figure the delays on the other end, there can be a big time savings if you had the availability of an airplane out of here. Charter is one way of doing it. I think a lot of people that own airplanes, if you had the choice to charter or to own your own, if you own it, you tend to let somebody else write the checks and you don't make the decision on a daily basis as to what the cost of having that airplane is. Where if you charter, you go down, you call them up, and they say, well, to do this trip, it's going to cost you $4,000 or $5,000, and they gulp. But you don't think about it when you're doing it the other way. I don't think we can really justify owning the airplane in terms of dollars and cents, but there's convenience, business purposes where it does make it work.
Dan, did you have a quick statement?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. To get to Representative Riley's concern about helicopter noise, tonight the City of Salem has also commissioned its staff to do a study on helicopter noise and how that impacts the Salem airport. So I'll be happy to get that information and forward on to the committee to see how other communities are dealing with that as well. And that's the only statement I had to make.
Great.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, just one comment I'd make before we finish, and that is the question was asked earlier with Bob and Ann when they were here about what is it that attracts people to Oregon. We recently located a company in the Rogue Valley called Amy's Kitchen, and Amy's grew from a facility in Santa Rosa, California. The humorous part of that whole process was that our Governor Kulongowski got in a wrestling match with Governor Schwarzenegger, and so it isn't all based on size.
The fight and the dog.
And we won. But we won because of water, sewer capacity, energy, workers' comp rates. The cost of putting the plant in, even if you pay a lot more at the beginning, going back to your concern about labor's in terms of the whole picture 10 years down the road, the labor to build it is a very small part of it, but it's what goes on after that, and that's how we compete. Quality of life is important. Another thing we hear is that you could take a company like Amy's and you can show them the costs and everything can be right, but when the executives that are going to move here and live here bring their spouse along and say, this is where we're going, if you can't show them the things, the arts, the other quality items that they would like to have Nordstrom's, then they might say, heck no, I'm not going to go there. So that's another one of those things we have to watch.
Thank you both so very much. And Mike, thank you for your service to the state and making
sure
that we're going to remain competitive in the aviation industry.
We will.
Thank you. Just a note to the committee as well as our panelists that we have four more witnesses here, so we're going to try and pick the tempo up just a little bit. I'd like to call up Doug Tindall from the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Doug Tindall. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Good morning.
Glad to be here today to talk about the transportation infrastructure. You've heard a lot about the infrastructure requirements. I'm going to be a little bit more focused. And Chair Witt, I will be brief. Oregon's transportation infrastructure is critical to the economy, and we've seen this over and over again when we did the OTIA, the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, number three, to repair state bridges. The estimates of the economic damage to the state if freight stops flowing are massive. But it's more than just highways. It's also rail. The Pacific Northwest, we are well positioned in Oregon for moving freight both through the state and within the state and to ports internationally. We have a rail system that's the only river grade, the only one that runs along the river in the U.S. interior, or to the U.S. interior, rather. We have a strong marine component with international container ports, where Oregon serves as a hub for the inland northwest of the Columbia and Snake Rivers. You just heard about aviation. I don't know that I can add anything to that. We have it is a vital part of moving people around, and we also have a transit system that or transit systems that move hundreds of thousands of people a day. And in addition to providing choices and alternative travel for the elderly and the disabled. So it's a transportation is multifaceted in the state, and Oregon is, because of our position geographically, even more important to us possibly than were we not on the coast. The handout that I was passed out to you is a summary of the Oregon Transportation Plan. This is the plan People have asked questions, what do you have a plan? Well, the Oregon Transportation Plan gathered many, many, many people together and crafted a vision for where we need to go with transportation in all aspects of transportation. I'm going to point out three challenges in particular, and Ms. Lucene from the Port of Portland is going to talk about the congestion issues, which will be another one in addition to these challenges. But Oregon's population is growing. Anticipated by 2030 that the population will gain 41% from where we are today, which means more people are traveling, and we need to provide an infrastructure for those people to travel on. The global freight challenge, as I said, we are well positioned in Oregon because of where we sit geographically. The total number of tons moved to, from, and within Oregon are anticipated to increase by 80% by 2030, and that's even a higher percentage in the Portland metropolitan area. And safety. We continue to see recurring accidents and unsafe intersections that will be compounded by the increase in both freight traffic and the increase in the number of people. So this document, just to tell you kind of a status of where we are, the document concludes with a breakout based on what were called all feasible needs of $1.3 billion a year shortfall from where we need to be to have and maintain a strong and vibrant transportation system over the next 25 years. And I am hesitant to say this because it's not pleasant to bring bad news, but that is actually a conservative estimate because the estimates in the rail components are not as strong as those in the other components because the rail is primarily owned by private sector, and we don't have good numbers from them in terms of what the overall needs would be. So we have a transportation system today that moves freight through and people through and in Oregon, and it's critical to keep that transportation in good shape in the coming years to assure that we maintain a strong economy in the state of Oregon. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do we need to do to improve the level of communication and, I'm not sure what the word is, management attention to Oregon's rail system?
Chair Whitmer.
I mean, I have the same. You're raising that issue reminds me of a set of concerns that I've had for some time about the railroad being managed out of Omaha with attention. Oregon's a pretty small place compared to other parts of their system. What do we do to get their attention and get them focused here so we can get our work done?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, I don't know that I have an answer that I can assure you will work. I can tell you, though, that Connect Oregon 1 attracted attention of Burlington Northern, Santa Fe, and the Union Pacific, and because they were seeing that Oregon was willing to invest in rail, in alternate modes of transportation. And how that will play out over the long term and in terms of whether or not they will come to Oregon and make improvements, I can't tell you that. I can tell you that at the department level, we meet with the executives from both of those Class I railroads, and the relationship is better from my standpoint than it was, but they are reticent to share their overall strategy. We do know in their business plan that the more leverage you can bring in terms of a local government or a state government, the better their return on investment looks. And so as we have our discussions with them, we try and think along those lines of how can we best work together. But it is a difficult conversation because it is dealing with the private sector. Let me just add one other thing that's being discussed at the federal level is the potential for tax credits, investment tax credits for rail. And again, the concern there from the Oregon standpoint is how do we know that if Oregon delegation votes for investment tax credits at the federal level for rail projects, how do we know that those are going to come to Oregon? And I don't believe that our delegation has those assurances yet, but they
they have raised those issues.
Representative Jerome. Whoops.
Thank you, Chair Whip. Oops. Did you have a follow-up? My question goes back to what I asked before, and that is Portland, if you drive up there and after 4 o'clock on Friday or almost any day, there's a real capacity problem as far as transportation, as far as auto transportation goes. It seems to me that we kind of live in a world of two states, if you think about it. And that is, no matter how we fund the rest of Oregon, the Tri-County area is always in need of more money. Has there been any thought given to a differential tax rate for, say, the gas tax in order to help fund some of this in the Tri-County area?
Chair Whip, Representative Girard, personally, when I go to Portland, I take the train. There are a number of cities in the state that have enacted their own gas taxes. So there are we already have that. We already see that differential. Milwaukee has one. I believe Tiger just enacted one. And there are a number of others that are not springing to my mind. Additionally, we are now starting to hear with the concerns of the loss of the forest timber receipt money that counties are looking at doing that very same thing. So those possibilities exist. I'm not aware of any structure where you've looked at that on a overall basis to figure out who needs what. It's more locally driven as the locals see the needs and are compelled to increase their revenues where we've seen those in the past.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is somewhat different. We are concerned the moving of the freight, but I'm also concerned the security of the road, especially freight lines. In these days, it could happen, and sabotage by the terrorist, whatever group. Do we have any plans in place in case such things happens? Could we prevent it, or if it happens, and what plans were in place? Because that has been my thought many, many times before.
Chair Whip, Representative Lim, a couple of different aspects of that. We have done, the state of Oregon has done an extensive survey of the transportation system to determine those areas that are at the greatest risk, and we have taken some steps through the use of cameras and in some of our buildings that are critical to the structures, some alarm systems and so forth. So we are addressing that in a proactive way and trying to make sure that it doesn't happen. Additionally, there is a network of that's mostly the trucking organization to a structure to call in when they see something that looks unusual, and so there's a number of proactive things that have been done to better assure the security of the transportation system. Should something happen, we have the Department of Transportation what's called an all hazards plan. In other words, we have a plan that we're ready to respond regardless of what it is, whether it's a landslide, natural disaster like a landslide, or whether it would be something man caused disaster as in terrorism. We have a structure in place to be able to respond to that and make sure that we can get the transportation system back in operation as quickly as possible.
Doug, as a committee whose focus is on workforce and economic development, from your vantage point, what would you say would be priority needs for transportation in our state?
Well, Chair Witt, the OTIA packages bring about, and the estimate is, and there's a pretty good background for this, that we about 17 jobs are created for every $1 million of expenditure, or sustained rather, for every $1 million of expenditure. And so in the last year, as we ramp up in Connect Oregon, we sustained over 12,000 jobs, and this is in the construction industry. The issue, I think, that we need to keep out in front of everyone is this is a because this was bonded revenues, this is a bubble. And you're starting to see it when the consulting engineers already, the work, the design work is primarily done. The construction bubble or the construction peak will occur a couple years from now. But there's already a concern that, well, we ramped up and we have a really vibrant, created a very vibrant industry in terms of engineering consulting in this state. And now there's some question about how are we going to keep those people in this state, because that's a transportable knowledge base that we've created. And so I know that the consulting engineers are very concerned about what does a stable transportation funding look like, so that we have not only stable funding, we can have something that, on which we can plan for investments in the transportation system, but also how do we have a stable funding that, that maintains that knowledge base and skill base that we've built up in Oregon.
Representative Dahlin, last question for Doug.
Thanks. Thank you, Doug. With the Department of Transportation, when we have a, I guess I'm going to ask you which comes first, the chicken or the egg. Do we build a transportation system and then look for the communities to grow around that? Or when the communities grow, how does the Department of Transportation respond? For example, I have two communities that I represent, the Dalles, where we've been growth starved for a long time. When we have an opportunity to grow, does ODOT have a plan to grow with us? Or how does that work?
Chair Webb, Representative Dallum, excellent question. I could spend, and I won't, but I could spend probably half an hour talking about the relationship between land use and transportation and how critical that is. Ideally, if we could look out into the future and figure out where growth was going to occur, we'd put that infrastructure in place before it happened, because it's cheaper to do it. You don't have to buy the right-of-way, which as growth occurs, right-of-way costs go up and so forth. But we don't have that luxury. And so we are in more of a reactive mode. And what's happening is, as growth is occurring, the area commissions on transportation are looking then at what needs did that growth cause, and how do we develop projects to address those kinds of needs. So ideally, we would be proactive. That's a very, very difficult thing to get to because of the way the land use planning works in the horizons that you look at. It's very hard to do, and the Portland urban growth boundary expansion to the east presented us with a significant challenge, because not only in your community in the Dalles, but even in the Portland area, we don't have the transportation infrastructure to support that urban growth boundary expansion. But after it happened, we have projects out there that we're looking at doing to grow with the community.
Okay, follow up to that. Would it be appropriate for ODOT to have a fund for that? Because it seems to me, as we look at particularly overpasses and growing communities, that this problem happens. I know it's happening in Bend. I know it's happening in Hood River. I know it's happening in the Dalles. But we seem to have no contingency plan, no rainy day fund, no place for ODOT to turn when growth gets ahead of them. We put a lot of money in bridges. Is it appropriate that we have a fund so that when growth gets ahead of you, ODOT can react with the community? There is the potential for ODOT to starve a community out of growth because they can't keep up. Would it be appropriate to...
Well, Chair Whip, Representative Dallum, I think it is an ODOT issue. It's also all of the other transportation providers, because the same thing can happen with city streets. You can actually outgrow the city's capacity to have city streets. The one thing I didn't mention, Director Repine mentioned this, maybe Ms. Hannes, but one of the other rep mentioned that we do have it's not large, but we have what's called an immediate opportunity fund. It's a very surgical tool that we can go into when there is growth, when there is economic development occurring in a particular area, we can use some of that money, and that is a very quick action. To the larger problem, I guess it's kind of a situation where it would be difficult to say we've got this much money, and we're only going to spend part of that money because we want to save some of that to plan and be proactive in the future when you've got so many needs today in all of the congestion. It's hard for me to say, no, I'm not going to spend every dollar you give me because I have so many projects that I can't get to now. So that's kind of the challenge, I think.
That is a rather familiar refrain.
thank
you very much.
Doug, thank you so very, very much. Appreciate that. In the interest of time, I'm going to call up two folks together here in a panel. Susie Lassine from the Port of Portland and Kelsey Wilson from the Oregon Transit Association.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susie Lassine. I'm a manager of transportation and land use policy for the Port of Portland. And I guess I'll go ahead and start. The Port of Portland has been working with the business community in partnership to improve Oregon's transportation system. The information that's being passed out to you today is really two items. One is a brochure which represents some work that we are doing with the business community that summarizes basically some of the challenges, some of the progress that's been made on transportation infrastructure, and some of the opportunities that we have looking forward. I'm also passing out basically a PowerPoint which summarizes the cost of congestion study that was done in partnership with a number of public agencies as well as private businesses for the Portland metropolitan area. A similar congestion and connection study, if you will, is being done statewide and is expected to be rolled out at the end of this month. So you'll be hearing more about that in the next several weeks. There basically are 5 points from the cost of congestion study that I'd like to highlight today. One is the growth in travel. If you look on the first page, basically there are a number of reasons why we're anticipating more travel, more growth in travel. Partially population growth, but it's also the nature of the way business operates today. There's we're in a global marketplace. We are expanding our buyer and supplier markets. There's more emphasis on overnight delivery, internet sales, for example. And there are absolutely a real, true lack of alternatives, as you all have discussed here today, for some types of business travel. The second point that I want to make is the relationship of the Portland metropolitan area, and that includes Vancouver, as a gateway to both international and national markets. So the businesses that are throughout the state rely largely on access to those markets through the Portland metropolitan area. Because of that transportation infrastructure that was there, investments were made many years ago, many of the businesses, what we call traded sector businesses, have chosen to locate in the metropolitan area and the surrounding state. For this reason, we are much more transportation dependent than many, I'd say, than the U.S. on average. And for that reason, the transportation system plays a very important role in our economy. The third point I want to make is what we learned from this study in interviewing a number of businesses and what we know from national statistics is that the emphasis on businesses today is really on managing their logistics or supply chain, orchestrating the way that they move their products cost-effectively and efficiently. This is a combination of both telecommunications but also transportation infrastructure. And to the extent that we can provide a system that's both connected and efficient, that helps them become more productive as businesses. The fourth point is just the impact of congestion on businesses. And if you'll flip to page 5, there's a quick summary of some of the implications of the impact of congestion on those businesses. It certainly affects their delivery reliability, worker commuting, operations and overtime costs, additional drivers, inventory costs, and shifts and cutoff times. So the last point I want to make is that because of that impact, because it basically affects their ability to be competitive, looking at transportation investment was really kind of the key to understanding how that relationship is going to be in the future. We looked at two levels of investment. One was the current based on known revenues, and then a higher level of investment. With the current investment based on known revenues, there was still an extremely high amount of delay on the system, which had a ripple effect to those businesses. With higher levels of investment, it provides nearly $1 billion dollars per year in economic benefit. That includes 6,500 permanent jobs, 2,000 to 3,000 construction jobs per year, and a return on investment of about 2 to 1. For every dollar invested, $2 comes back to the economy, and that's a number I think that you've heard earlier today. That concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Susie. I think what I'm going to do is, before we open it up for questions here, we'll hear from Kelsey.
Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelsey Wilson. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Transit Association. In 1978, the Oregon Transit Association was formed by the state's three largest transit providers as a nonprofit association to represent transit interests at the state capitol. Today, we have 70 members, big and small, across the state and beyond. In front of you, you have an information piece put together by TriMet with information gathered from many of the transit agencies across the state about the economic impact of public transit in Oregon. I'd like to highlight a few of the points for you. The first way transit contributes to the economy is through its generation of jobs and significant return on investment. A capital investment in public transit prompts a flurry of business activity for hundreds of industries, from specialized rail or bus construction companies to maintenance and software suppliers. These investments also translate into significant increases in business revenues and profits. According to a Cambridge Systematics Incorporated study, every $10 invested in transit capital projects yields $30 in business sales. And the same investment in transit operations generates $32 in business sales. In 2004 through 2006, Lane Transit District injected more than $27 million job-creating construction dollars into the local economy. Over the next 8 years, LTD plans to invest an additional $30 million construction dollars into the local economy. Each of these dollars will generate an additional $1.50 to $3 in local economic benefit. Another way transit contributes to economic benefit is through its relief of congestion and it improves the business productivity. According to the Texas Transportation Institute's 2004 Urban Mobility Report, public transportation systems have saved regions in the study area 1.1 billion hours of additional roadway delay and an additional congestion cost of $20 billion. In the Portland Metropolitan Service Area, the TTI report estimates public transportation saves the region nearly 14.2 million hours of delay annually, resulting in savings of $256 million per year that would have been spent on fuel and other road driving related costs. Transit connects workers to jobs and training in urban, suburban, and rural areas. Public transportation provides real and needed savings for many entry-level workers coming into the workforce who are so critical to Oregon's economy. Half of all the rides taken on the Corvallis transit system are by OSU students, faculty, and staff, and employees of Hewlett-Packard. In Lane County, Jack Roberts said, "One of the first thing large employers ask about when thinking of locating here is where are the transit lines and how convenient is it for their employees to get to work." Transit stimulates economic development around its stations. Supported by a steady stream of pedestrians and transit riders, transit-oriented developments are growing up around transit stations to provide easy access to a mix of housing, employment, retail, and leisure activities. Springfield Station, a transit and retail development opened in October of 2004, is the first new development in downtown Springfield in 30 years. In a convenient downtown location, the development offers 3,444 square feet for retail space. Transit helps maintain the vitality of our city's central business districts. Reducing the need for parking spaces in our economic centers is a key benefit of transit, allowing for better land use and a greater concentration of people. Whether riding to work, study, or play, transit riders make our unique urban forms possible. Rogue Valley Transportation District has an agreement with the City of Ashland for reduced fares in the city. Since the program started 2.5 years ago, ridership has tripled. This represents over 20,000 monthly trips within the city. Transit contributes to the independent and productive lives for seniors and people with disabilities. Transportation services for the elderly and people with disabilities promotes independent living beyond one's ability to drive safely. It allows aging in place, which strengthens local economies and saves the state higher costs associated with assisting living. Transit is especially important for connecting residents in rural and semi-rural areas with regional services to the nearest metropolitan area. Salem Kaiser, Lane Transit District, and TriMet provide over 11.5 million fixed route trips per day to elderly and disabled riders, as well as an additional 1.2 million paratransit trips for those who cannot use the fixed route system. Transit helps achieve clean air standards and reduces energy consumption. According to a 2002 report by economists Dr. Robert Shapiro of the Brookings Institution and Dr. Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute, public transportation saves more than 855 million gallons of gasoline and 45 million barrels of oil a year. This is equivalent to the energy used to heat, cool, and operate one quarter of all American homes annually. So you've heard public transit does a great deal to benefit Oregon's economy. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kelsey. Questions for our panel. Yes, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chairman. Back to my previous line of questioning. This is for the Port of Portland, the handout that you had, page 7.
Yes.
Okay, the key congested corridor. The question being, on page 8 as well, you have an investment that you feel is needed of $6.2 billion. I'm kind of a dollars and cent guys. What can we do to? I'm looking for funding mechanisms. And obviously, if the port feels like we need to, you know, do some of this, what can the port do as far as? As helping to raise $6.2 billion, what can the state do? And this can't be all the responsibility of one entity. So can you enlighten me on that?
Representative Girard, I'll do my best. Mr. Chair, Representative Girard. I think when you look at the region's transportation plan, the assumption is that there will be a contribution from federal, state, and local government. So that $6.2 billion covers all of those governmental structures in terms of funding. Obviously, we do not have those funds for the Portland metropolitan area at this point in time, and the state is facing similar challenges in other communities. What the Port of Portland has been doing is working with the business community in both educating and raising awareness about the relationship between transportation investment and business productivity. But I think that means that, increasing our transportation infrastructure revenues is going to be critically important for the state in order to remain competitive. So that includes things like a second Connect Oregon, potentially, a transportation investment package for roads that includes both maintenance and other aspects of the road system. And it certainly includes working with our federal delegation to the extent possible to secure funds from at the federal level.
Other questions? I share Representative Girard's concern over the gridlock that occurs in the metropolitan area from time to time. The easy fix would seem to be to build additional highway infrastructure, those sorts of things, for all of the good reasons that you list here in your handout. The concern that I have is if we build it, then they come and more come, and I'm wondering if either of you have a potential
solution to suggest for that. Is it, are we looking at a system perhaps of private roads, of toll roads around the metropolitan area? What's the solution to this? Because this certainly is a major impact and not a positive one at all in terms of our state's economy. There's an awful lot of overtime that's lost. There's a lot of fuel that's burned up. There's just highway madness, if nothing else, because of this. Any suggestions on that?
Well, Chair Witt, let me just take a stab at it, and then I'll turn it over to you. I don't think there's a silver bullet. I think it's a combination of efforts that includes increasing revenues to address the most immediate needs, to look at key bottlenecks, and you may want to look at them relative to the kind of return on investment that you might receive. In other words, are there parts of the system that are particularly critical for the businesses, for business community, and for businesses to remain productive? Is reliability critical to some of those businesses? And if so, where are those investments and where should they be made? I think there are intelligent transportation system improvements that can be made, smart corridors, for example. Certainly, transit investment is another. There are things that Commissioner Sam Adams in the city of Portland is looking at in terms of how do you quickly remove crashes from the freeway system. So I think it's a combination of things. It's not a simple solution. Increased revenues are a key component of that, but it's a number of things that need to be considered.
I would echo that. From a transit perspective, public transportation is the way to go.
Great. Everybody hop on board public transportation. With that, thank you both so very, very much. I appreciate your very good testimony. And last up today, Chris Tamarin from OECDD.
Let's sit here a second.
Can we make it before 10, Chris?
We will try. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. For the record, my name is Chris Tamarin. I'm with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. This morning I'll be giving you a presentation on Oregon's telecommunications infrastructure. I will cover wireless, which I know is an interest, but I want to provide you with a little broader view of telecommunications infrastructure for context, and also because wireless networks are not standalone. They interconnect with and depend on other networks using other technologies. I'd like to begin by noting that telecommunications is recognized in Oregon law as a key element of infrastructure right along with roads, bridges, water systems, and electric power. And it is a legislative finding that the improvement, expansion, and new construction of the state's telecom infrastructure, along with other types, provides the basic framework for continuing and expanding economic activity, providing jobs and economic opportunity. Here's an illustration of telecom infrastructure and what it consists of. It's built of distribution networks that provide access and connectivity, delivering voice, data, image, and video services to end users in their homes, their businesses, hospitals, schools, and institutions. Examples of local distribution networks include the local telephone company exchange, local cable company network, wireless service provider networks, and competitive access provider networks. It also consists of backbone networks. These are high-capacity facilities that extend across a city or region or wide area. They connect local telephone exchanges, local cable networks, and wireless networks to the World Wide Web and to the national and global networks that give us our any-place-to-any-place communications capability. That's what enables us to send and receive email on our computers and our BlackBerries, walk out in the lobby to a payphone, or use our cell phone to complete a call to Portland, New York, London, or Tokyo. The backbone networks connect local distribution networks to the world. And we can note that wireless technologies are used throughout all segments of the network infrastructure, as well as end-user systems, from the Bluetooth headset that communicates with your cell phone, the cell phone that communicates with the cell tower, the microwave systems that provide segments of the backbone, and satellite systems that provide both distribution and backbone applications. With its many different technologies, telecom infrastructure is critical to the state of Oregon and will continue to grow in importance with economic globalization and as more and more of us do our jobs by processing and communicating information. From an infrastructure standpoint, regardless of whether it's wireless, optic fiber, or coaxial cable, or another technology, the interest is in advanced telecommunications facilities, which is defined in Oregon statutes as meaning high-speed, broadband telecom infrastructure that enables users to send and receive high-quality voice, data, and video using any technology. And I like this definition because it recognizes that there are many technologies available. Given that background, telecom infrastructure has become a real asset for Oregon over the past years, a strengthened strategic asset. Significant improvements in the state's infrastructure have been made with the construction of multiple networks, fiber optic backbone networks, fiber optic distribution networks, DSL services over twisted pair copper networks, fiber and coaxial cable, third generation mobile wireless, Wi-Fi, as well as enhanced satellite networks. And our timing has been good. As telecom has grown to be a priority site selection criterion for businesses of all sizes and even for personal residences, many people demand broadband services in their homes. If they can't get it, they don't want the house or they can't live in the community. The infrastructure projects that resulted from Senate Bill 622 several sessions ago and that were administered by OECD included the construction of five major fiber optic rings that significantly improved the availability and reliability of telecommunication services statewide. The projects included the installation of network technologies that reduced the cost of services as well to outstate regions. It also included the installation of DSL, voice messaging, and video conferencing to communities around the state. This Quest fiber backbone is not the only backbone in the state. Oregon is served by major carriers with an abundance of fiber backbone network facilities with virtually unlimited capacity. Others include Electric Lightwave, the purchase of which was recently completed by Integra Telecom, a company headquartered in Portland. LS Networks, also headquartered in Portland, a company that last year completed another major fiber ring covering the east and west side of the mountains. And 360 Networks, along with other carriers, including the networks of Verizon, CenturyTel, Embark, Charter Communications, Comcast, Wiltel, Time Warner, XO Communications, AT&T, and others. Again, these backbone networks are essential because they provide the connectivity, or as it's sometimes referred to, the backhaul, that local telephone, cable, and wireless networks need in order to connect to the rest of the world. Competitive local fiber distribution networks have been deployed in Portland, Sandy, Ashland, Hermiston, The Dalles, Hood River, Bend, Coos Bay, North Bend, Roseburg, Klamath Falls, Medford, and new networks were completed last year in Bandon, Monmouth, and Independence. These networks provide communities with additional high-bandwidth services, capacity and route diversity, and fiber networks that are separate from the incumbent telephone companies. And the incumbent telephone companies themselves, from Quest to Cambitel, have also been steadily upgrading their distribution networks with fiber. Verizon is currently building a fiber-to-the-prem network that will reach over 60,000 homes in Washington County, including parts of Tigard, Beaverton, and Hillsborough. Verizon plans to reach 80,000 more Oregon homes, expanding south to Wilsonville, McMinnville, Dundee, and Newburgh, and east to Gresham and Troutdale. Their Fios, or fiber optic service, network will deliver up to 5 megabits per second upstream and 30 megabits per second downstream to business and residential customers. Another increasingly strategic component of Oregon's telecom infrastructure is the undersea cables that come ashore in Oregon. There are currently 11 undersea cables that come ashore in Oregon, positioning us as a telecom gateway to the Pacific Rim. Oregon's major telephone companies, including CenturyTel, Verizon, and Embark, which is formerly Sprint United, have also been aggressively deploying DSL services. Quest brought DSL to 54 new communities under Senate Bill 622 and then went on to deploy DSL in all of its Oregon wire centers. Oregon's progressive independent telephone companies and cooperatives like Cambitel, Mount Angel Telephone, and the Halem Telephone have also been deploying DSL, resulting in widespread availability across the state. Cable companies such as Charter, Ben Broadband, and Comcast have been actively deploying fiber coax systems and upgrading their equipment to provide two-way data communications, voice services, and are now providing commercial-grade network services to businesses, hospitals, and government. In the 3 years since it arrived here, Comcast has invested $150 million in its Oregon infrastructure. Which brings us to wireless. In addition to these significant landline improvements, multiple wireless networks have been built to provide internet, data, and voice communication services around the state. Wireless networks such as the Eastern Oregon Network and Unicom have been deployed to offer internet access services. Easy Wireless in the Hermiston-Boardman area is frequently cited in national publications as the largest Wi-Fi or wireless fidelity data network in the country, covering approximately 700 square miles. Portland, Corvallis, The Dalles, and other cities are exploring building Wi-Fi networks to provide wireless internet access in downtown areas and beyond. Mobile wireless carriers, including Sprint, T-Mobile, Singular, and Verizon Wireless, have been turning up third-generation technology and providing 3G services, providing users with 70 kilobits per second up to 144 kilobits per second for internet access over mobile wireless networks. Last year, Unicell invested over $10 million in a 3G upgrade to its network in central and eastern Oregon. And another wave of wireless networks is in the planning stage, with the deployment of new technology that will deliver fixed, portable, and mobile wireless broadband service without the need for direct line of sight. This new technology is called WiMAX, which stands for Worldwide Interoperability for Microwave Access. In a typical cell radius of 3,000 to 30,000 feet, WiMAX can be expected to deliver up to 40 megabits per second per channel for fixed and portable access, and mobile systems are expected to deliver 15 megabits per second. Intel is also planning an aggressive marketing strategy for WiMAX, and Intel's international WiMAX marketing organization is headquartered here in Oregon. A company named Clearwire is currently serving Eugene, Springfield, Roseburg, Medford, Grants Pass, Cay Falls, Prineville, Madras, Bend, and Sisters with a proprietary version of WiMAX. And C-Turn Corporation, a company headquartered here in Salem, is planning to build multiple WiMAX networks in Oregon. C-Turn has been approved by the USDA Rural Utility Service for financing to build networks in 76 Oregon communities. Satellite services have been improving and now are capable of two-way data communications and may be used anywhere in the state with a view of the southern sky. Wild Blue Communications began service in 2005 and offers download speeds of up to 1.5 megabits per second and upload speeds of up to 256K. HughesNet offers download speeds of up to 2 megabits per second and upload speeds of up to 500 kilobits per second. Another broadband wireless network on its way. Analog television broadcasts are currently scheduled to end in this country by February 17, 2009. The digital technology that will be deployed by the Oregon Public Broadcasting System to replace its analog systems will also enable it to data cast, which means to use available bandwidth for two-way internet protocol data transmission. Oregon Public Broadcasting will need to deploy 55 digital translators to replace its analog signal coverage, with potential uses of digital emergency alert, public safety applications, and education and workforce development. And finally, in this legislative session, the Oregon State Interoperability Executive Council is recommending a statewide digital trunked radio system to provide a new interoperable public safety network throughout the state. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning, and I hope that I'll be able to answer any questions, and I hope we can keep this on time.
You did a great job. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The price tag on that last system, frankly, is enough to choke a horse. Are we working on ways to piggyback
our needs onto one or more of these commercial systems that are going into place so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel and can actually use facilities that actually belong to other people, or some other arrangement that will reduce the cost. Frankly, I think it's going to be very difficult for us to come up with the money.
Chair Witten and Representative Bernhardt, yeah, the last estimated cost I heard associated with the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network was around $665 million.
That's the number I'm referring to, yeah. Yes.
The State Interoperability Executive Council has been working on developing an interoperable network plan for the state for the past year, 5 years. They have a conceptual design that they have developed. I believe it's their intent when they do go to RFP for the systems to open solution proposals for the interoperable network to multiple technologies, any other alternative solutions that service providers or responders to the RFP would want to submit.
Thank you. May I just follow up?
Please.
Very briefly, we have to figure out a way to get the cost down. We have no provision for this in our budget, and I can't think of no way of finding this kind of money.
Vice Chair Riley.
I'll pass. I had the same question.
Representative Dahlin.
I wonder, Chris, if I might call you later. I have a dear friend. She's been working on cell phone service in Central Oregon for a long time, and I'd like to visit with you about that. But in deference to the time, I'd do that in my office if you could.
Thank you so very, very much, Chris. Rick, a quick preview of Wednesday's hearing.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Wednesday the 21st, you'll be having a public hearing and work session on three bills, HB 2253, HB 2261, and HB 2412. And again, that's set for this coming Wednesday at 8 a.m.
What was the first one there, Rick?
House Bill 2253, then 2261, then 2412.
With that, our committee is adjourned. Thank you all very much.